Hi, everybody. Thanks for joining us today. It's a privilege to be here, kind of putting forward a few of the bits of research that we've been muddling through in Portland. And it's actually, I find, a really well-integrated session, because what I'll be talking about really dovetails, I think, nicely from what both the previous presenters have remarked on. And this work, while it's an ambitious title, I'm just going to carve off a little piece of what is a broader discussion that we're having today. And my interest is really kind of thinking about this from a places perspective. Planners and people in urban design have been really thinking a lot about the importance of place and health. And so where I'm coming at this from is kind of at a 30,000 foot level, literally, and I'm going to bring that down to actually individual neighborhoods and try to get into the actions that we can take this research to point this research towards. And so before I jump into it, of course, my disclosure: I know nobody, I have no connections, I have no relationships to disclose, I work in a lab alone. No, really, the discussion about Summer in the City and the title that the organizers put together, I think, works really well, because way back when we were, before I was born, before our president was born, Elizabeth Taylor and Paul Newman put together an Oscar-winning performance. But since that time, we've seen a number of changes occur from a climate perspective. And part of this has to do with, of course, this scientific analysis of how many parts per million of CO2 and other greenhouse gases are in the atmosphere, and a number of global global climate models that have actually started to be unequivocally pointing towards a direction about where we're headed in this big steamship that's moving along at super speeds at this stage. And the overall climate, what we've understood from these models, as well as from empirical data, is that we've got about 1 degree increase in Celsius. And of course, the consumption of what's happening across the globe has really increased the number of, quote, planets that we are the number of planets that require our consumptive needs. And since then, we've had a guy who's come forward and said something about truth or inconvenience or something like that that's had to do with climate change and winning Nobel Prize around this issue. So it's become, needless to say, and I think aware, this audience is particularly aware of a very pressing issue that we're trying to work with. I don't want to go into this. I'm sure many of you have read IPCC. I've heard this quoted many times today. But climate models, again, pointing towards a variety of different, quote, futures that we might encounter. And so this really lends us to this question of adaptation. And much of what my remarks are about today are, where do we go from here? What are the types of plans that cities can work on, that regions can work on at a regional scale, sub-city scale, the neighborhood scale, for actually starting to work proactively towards addressing some of what seems to be an inevitably increase in the variability of climate future. So to kind of contextualize my remarks today, I'm really focusing on one aspect of this much broader issue, and the aspect that, as all of you and as the previous presenters have, I think, identified, I'm really looking just at this aspect of heat stress. And I'm not coming at this from a medical perspective. I'm not coming at this from a public health necessarily perspective. But my question is, OK, what can we do about this from a planning point of view, from a urban studies point of view, to actually start addressing some of these questions that are so intimately connected to how we plan our cities? So again, heat stress is something that is one piece of a much larger puzzle that we're all discussing today, and I look forward to talking about the other possibilities and the other types of imperatives that are part of the public health discourse today. Again, I don't need to go into this. I think this is something all of you are familiar with, but what I do find interesting as I dig into this more and more is the simple fact that Kleinenberg gets at in a number of different ways, that of all the kind of sensationalized natural disasters that we see, more people in the U.S. die from heat waves than all other extreme meteorological events combined. And it's kind of the silent killer, as it's often referred to. And I think all of you are familiar with this. What you may not all be familiar with is some of the downscaled climate models that have been emerging out of the University of Washington, looking at what's happening in the region I live in. And part of what motivates some of the work that I'm discussing today. For example, climate impacts groups suggest that human health, where under medium warming scenarios, more people are projected to die because of heat waves. In King County, for example, which is the county that Seattle is in, it's projected by 2025 there could be 101 additional deaths among people 45 and older. By 2045, there could be an additional 156 deaths. Poor air quality in the summers will also contribute to more deaths by mid-century. So kind of a doom and gloom scenario. We've got a lot of concerns that are coming down the pike here, and it's really got us thinking about how we go about planning our regions. So this puts us in a perspective of, we got some funding from the National Science Foundation in this coupled human natural systems project, not looking specifically at this aspect, but the data produced from this project allowed us to kind of segue nicely into addressing this question of what are the spatial implications of urban heat on human communities and what actions are needed for mitigating impacts. Again, big question, but we're going to kind of slice off just one piece of this for the purposes of the few minutes that I have today. I'll go into the methods in a little more detail in a minute, but using a series of spatial analytical techniques, data sets from a variety of different sources, we're starting to characterize what's going on at the sub-city scale. In order to take our study across the United States, what we wanted to do was use our living laboratory of Portland as a means for understanding what's happening on the ground. So what we did was we had a fleet of cars. We drove them all around the city on weekdays and weekends with temperature and relative humidity loggers every 5 seconds, and got an empirical measurement of various different times of the day. What were the temperatures in these various places? Of course, controlling for having a control location as well. And so what we've come up with is this kind of empirical map that really, as you might, if you know Portland at all, you might be able to suspect that there's a few patterns that emerge here in terms of various places where heat is evident. And what we're seeing is this really follows along a number of roadways. People are familiar with Portland. The highways are on there primarily, but the other roadways are evident through looking at this, particularly from census blocks. And what we can see across the region is a variation from -2 Celsius to about +2.5 degrees Celsius as well. It's a range of heat that we've observed across the region. And so this gets us to the question of, okay, now that we know what the actual temperatures in these locations, the actual relative humidity, let's see what's on the landscape. And let's look at this from a high resolution satellite image perspective and come up with ways to be able to translate this and kind of transport this to other parts of the country. So what we really found was, of all the measures we kind of explored, and there's a lot going on here, I'll just break it down to just essentially 3 points. One is that we wanted to get a good sense for what's on the landscape. We looked at a number of measures, and my background in remote sensing and GIS allowed me to kind of come up with this measure that's used often in stormwater management, and that's this notion of effective impervious surface. And we found that that was highly correlated to what was actually going on. And that's basically rooftops and roads, and we know that pretty well from previous studies that these are the kinds of surfaces on the landscape, like in Phoenix, like in various other parts that have been studied closely, that this is what absorbs heat, slowly releases it overnight, and this effective impervious surface is essentially a measure of how clumpy the concrete is, how kind of concentrated is it in various parts of Portland in this case, and we found a pretty high correlation, statistically significant correlation with it. And what we wanted to do is link that, since we can get satellite imagery for all the cities in the country, we can link that to a set of demographics that would allow us to then characterize who were the people living in places that had high effective impervious surface. So across these 13 cities, who were actually living there, and run a number of statistical models to be able to examine who's actually living in these locations. And so we kind of take block group level demographic data, block level impervious surface, effective impervious surface data, kind of overlay those and start to tease out who are the people living in these locations. These are the cities we've looked at where my main purpose here actually is to help is to essentially learn a great deal, but also establish a few collaborations with people in various places and who are doing similar studies in other parts, and some of which I've already heard today. But we essentially selected these cities based on a set of land cover and population density measurements, and so we ranged from almost 2 million to a little to about 200,000, so quite a range of populations, but densities that really match pretty well. And as a person in urban studies and planning, also want to look at the role that land use planning and particular policies play on the likelihood of exposing individuals or communities to heat waves. So what did we find? I want to draw your attention away from the scale on the bottom. That scale, I learned after I uploaded this presentation that I have an index that I've actually used for that scale. And what that is essentially to be interpreted as is an amount of effective impervious surface going from 0 to 100%. And so that aside, what we did was take this essentially K-mean cluster analysis, and I don't want to get into details of that, but what that does is essentially kind of reduces the difference between various populations and creates these clusters, if you will, of populations based on specific attributes such as age, such as race, ethnicity, such as income, such as one-person households, etc., and essentially combines that. And again, this is just drawing from previous literature that I've seen out there, including the Heat Vulnerability Index and other studies that are out there. So in Albuquerque, we can start identifying locations where the vulnerable populations, in this case, these clustered populations that are lower income, that are older, of different underrepresented racial and minority groups in these different places. And so this is essentially a way to identify specific sub-neighborhood levels where this relationship between effective impervious surface and vulnerable populations coexist. I did this for, again, those 13 cities. I don't want to go through all the 13 cities based on the amount of time I have, but Atlanta, Baltimore, Cincinnati. And these are kind of overlaid onto Google Earth images to kind of give a sense and transparency of what's actually on the landscape there. Where we are right here, Denver and Minneapolis, starting to identify specific locations, Tampa, and so on. So what we did with that is essentially say, okay, we have a graphic representation of what's happening on the landscape. Let's start to run some models to see, statistical models to see who's actually living there and see if we can link those to any specific demographics that are actually in those places. And what we found for these cities, and we have a number of different statistical models running, and for the purposes of this presentation, I'm just going to look at the OLS model that we've looked at to try to explore who's living there. And I have a few of these kind of results that I'd like to present to you today. Pittsburgh, for example, were similar to what we saw presented by Colleen, that there are different demographics in these different locations that are living adjacent to or right on these effective impervious surface areas. And what we're seeing is that as income goes up, for example, in Pittsburgh, the effective impervious surface goes down. And just even looking at the sign of each of these coefficients is really what we're immersed in at this point. As age goes up, 65 and up, we see an increase in the effective impervious surface. It's not the case necessarily with Denver, where places where there's more renters, it seems to be lower effective impervious surface, which is an interesting idiosyncratic result that we are still trying to tease out at this point. We kind of move through Houston, and I don't, again, have time to go through all of these particular locations, but this presentation will be up online for you to be able to kind of dig into any of the specifics as needed. And then what we found most interesting was one of the highest correlations or highest statistically significant results was Portland, where we were seeing this very very intentional urban growth boundary, very progressive kind of means for linking land use planning with environmental conservation. And so now we put that public health lens to this, and we start seeing that there's actually a higher predictability or a lower amount of variation in these particular populations exposed to effective impervious surface. Some people are kind of chalking this up to the fact that there may be higher densities in various places, and putting those densities in particular places may lend themselves to a greater exposure. And so what does this mean from a land use planning policy perspective? What does this mean from a actual engaging the community perspective? That's where we are right now, and I want to end with the final slide of what we're doing with this, or actually final two slides, but the first is what we're doing with this in the city of Portland, and again, to collaborate with other cities to try to see if there are ways to engage populations and communities with these results. In Portland, we've kind of pushed all this up. I teach courses in public participation, GIS, and what we want to do is engage communities in talking about their capacities, what are their capacities for actually addressing heat events, and some of the things that Natalie brought up earlier in terms of conducting qualitative analyses with communities about their capacity, about whether they see themselves as vulnerable or not. And we've worked with a number, we're starting to work now, I should say, with a number of organizations and looking for funding to actually work with these organizations, such as the Asian Pacific Islander Network of Oregon, Hispanic groups that are actually located, many of whom are located in these particular heat islands in the Portland region. So let me close with a question to you all, and hopefully to provoke a little bit of discussion towards the end, and I think it's not a question that's new to any of you, but if health disparities are differences in the incidence, prevalence, mortality, and burden of disease and other adverse health conditions that exist among specific population groups in the United States, then what implications does a changing climate have on social justice? As a thematic kind of, as a theme of the current conference we're engaged in. So let me close with the data folks who've come in terms of the FUSE project, Dave Saylor, who's a faculty in civil engineering, Linda George, who's an atmospheric chemist at Portland State faculty, and a number of graduate students who've been immersed in this work as well. And I'm happy to engage any questions after we're done here.